None of them were thrilled that I was calling for half of their workforce to get paid more. I knew what I was doing was controversial, but when I thought about it, I was like, I'm winning this Oscar for a woman struggling to raise her kids. And how would her life have been different? And how would my mom's life have been different?
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology builds?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us on The Tightrope, where we engage in a love and justice-infused dialogue, and we try ever so hard to keep our balance on an array of tough issues. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my dear friend, colleague, and brilliant human, Dr. Cornel West. Hey, Cornel, how are you feeling today?
Oh, it's always a joy to be in conversation with you, my dear sister, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I know. It's the funnest thing we've done. And I mean, I've done in a long time is do this show with you for sure. I wanted to say a couple of things and then sort of set you off on a path to see what's on your mind. I've been thinking this week about where we are with women and women's rights. And it's kind of remarkable that in my own lifetime, from adolescence to now, we've both gotten the right for reproductive choice, and it looks like we're going to lose it literally from my adolescence to now. I remember my mom took me to an impeach Nixon march in 1972 or three in the summer, and you know, all of the issues of Roe versus Wade were very prominent at the time, and you know, there was so much enthusiasm and excitement about finally women being free to control their own reproduction and the ERA. I mean, all of those. And, you know, I thought, oh, great. You know, I'm all set. You know, we're all good. It never occurred to me that before I would reach, you know, my 60s, that we literally be back to these battles again. I mean, what's your thinking on this? And how, you know, how can you help us sort of understand this? This catapulting, what feels to me like catapulting backward.
You know, I've been reading a lot of Dante, Inferno, and Triumph of Life, his recasting of Dante, right? Those last months before he died in 1822. And you remember he was wrestling with how could it be that there would be such major breakthroughs, in his case, French Revolution. And then the backlash, the repressive backlash, in our case, patriarchal and homophobic, transphobic and deeply white supremacist backlash against the attempts to try to stay in contact with the humanity and decency of each and every one of us. And we're living in a moment of intense backlash. It's grimmer, it's bleaker, and yet we have to remember the courage, the vision, the service, the sacrifice that went into it. And the question becomes, how do we have the same kind of courage in order to deal with this backlash? Because right. This neo-fascist escalation is as real as a heart attack. And one of the major focuses precisely on, you're right, on women's humanity, right to choose, women's freedom, but also just women's dignity. You know, this sense of debasing vulnerable groups, be it women, indigenous peoples, Mexicans, Muslims, Jews, Black people, Asians across the board. We've got to just fortify to fructify. You know, we got to be ready in order to generate the fruits. And the fruits are going to be highly sacrificial in this case because we're living in a counter-revolution in a massive way.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, this really ties into when you said we have to, you know, not only have courage, but, you know, be prepared and fortified in terms of, you know, partly knowing what's happened before, right? That courage comes not just from courage to fight, but to understand what the fight's about, the fact that it's been, you know, happened before, that it's been denied before. There's this quote from Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones, for some of the audience members who may not know both of his names, but he talks about the ability and the politics of people and movements finding the tracks of their activism erased. So they push the boulder back up the hill the same way as everybody else, because they the tracks of what happened have been erased. And I'm thinking a lot about education in relationship to this, and the, you know, women's history, and how rarely it's taught seriously, how much we fight to get the tiniest bit of African American history in the general curriculum, so that people are not only ignorant, literally, but then they're viciously ignorant and haughtily ignorant. And actual women and people of color themselves are also lacking a level of knowledge about the fights that come before. How would you connect that piece of the puzzle around education to the necessity of knowing what's happened before in order to have the courage and fortification for the battles we have ahead?
Mm-hmm. Well, there I think we have to have a subversive memory.
Mm.
Because in the end, it's really about seeing more clearly and feeling more deeply and acting more courageously. And patriarchy and predatory capitalist sensibilities tied to greed and racism, all these have to do in the end, it seems to me, with people who are not seeing the dignity and humanity of women and of working people and poor people, peoples of color, that they don't feel enough. They have compassion for their own little platoon, and it doesn't spill over to other people's right. communities and other people's nations. And then we've got too many cowards. You got too many conformists. They don't want to act courageously. They don't want to take a risk. They don't want to cut against the grain. Right. They don't want to have to bear the consequences of what it means to follow a vision that can get you in trouble. And that's a spiritual condition, you see. Mm-hmm. So that seeing and feeling and acting, that's the only way we can counter this deeply right-wing counter-revolution against the breakthroughs for women and other vulnerable groups, other groups that have been hated and haunted and hunted down. You know, that's really right. what we're talking about in terms of the Machiavellian quality.
But I mean, I mean, I totally agree with you, Cornell. But I want to push on this question of, you know, how do you get to the state that you're describing if you actually don't know the contours of your own oppression? I mean, I understand, you know, organic intellectuals and the knowledge that everyday people automatically have, but all women don't necessarily think of themselves as unfairly compensated in terms of compared to their male coworkers and so on. Women don't necessarily see reproductive rights and freedoms as reproductive rights and freedoms, right? So I guess the question is, how do we not only have the courage and the sight and foresight, but also the kind of knowledge base? How do we create a knowledge base that inspires that? Because I guess my argument is that we need that knowledge base.
You're right. But it's very much like white supremacy inside of Black people, that you got patriarchy inside of women. They've been taught right. to only see through a certain set of lens, and those lens are patriarchal lens, a deeply sexist lens. So those lens don't lend themselves to staying in contact with woman's genius, woman's mm-hmm. talents, woman's potential, woman's possibility. It is educational. In the end, though, I think it's really the artists who are going to lead the way. They've always been the vanguard of the species. Education is so easily co-optable by the powers that mm-hmm. be, by the status quo. The artists are the courageous ones, the visionary ones. We've talked about that before in terms yeah. of Shelley's unacknowledged legislatures of the world. He's right about that. Imagination and empathy will shatter all of the dogma and the doctrine. Mm. And that's, in the end, exemplary figures who are artists make a difference. And the way this leads directly into
it sure does.
Your sister today.
It sure yeah, does. Absolutely. We have an artist with us today. We're so delighted to have Patricia Arquette, who is an Oscar award-winning actress.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're delighted. We're delighted. I just want to tell our tightrope community a little bit about you before we launch into a rich conversation. Her Oscar acceptance speech electrified the audience and made headlines for calling out gender inequities in Hollywood. And many people believe this speech changed the Hollywood landscape forever. She's been a longtime activist for the Equal Rights Amendment and was a vocal participant in the 2017 Women's March. She was born in Chicago, but mostly remembers being raised on a commune in Virginia. It's quite a different scenario. Patricia, you're on the tightrope. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor to be here. And I love your conversation beforehand. I think I also grew up knowing really nothing about women's rights or the situation of women. And part of it, I think we have terrible education, public education, and even private education for kids. I mean, right. We have textbooks that are lying, that aren't telling the truth about Christopher Columbus, that really aren't getting into women's rights in a deep way. Yet we have professors who are experts in this. I mean, I think we really have to go to colleges, get great professors to write the textbook chapters on these subjects so that we have more information. I grew up really ignorant to all of it. It was only because my friend Kamala asked me to produce a film that she was doing, Kamala Lopez, and it was a documentary on women's rights, Equal Means Equal. And through the course of that and watching it and giving her notes about edits and so on, I learned a lot about women's rights.
And when was that? How old was that, recently or?
That was the year leading up to me winning the Oscar in 2015. Mm. And then I met Dr. West in 2016, right? Or at the end of 2015, when they had the platform committee for the Democratic Party, and I came in and they were talking about taking the ERA out of the Democratic platform at some point. The Democrats. Yeah. So, right. I mean, so I was talking about how these issues were still so pertinent to us right now.
Right.
You were quite powerful and eloquent then, and still are.
Thank you.
But tell us a little bit about Bentonville. What went into the making of that commune? Because it seems to me you did have some imagination and empathy cultivated there. And that's the kind of education that doesn't happen in the classroom.
That's true. Well, my mom was a civil rights activist and my parents were very political and they were part of the spiritual community called Subud. And they were like, well, why are we raising our kids in these cities? Why don't we have them in nature? Why don't we all live together? And then some were Jewish, some were Muslim. We could talk about comparative religion. We could talk about politics. They were musicians and artists. So we started to grow up in this very natural way, this communal way. And at this point now, being a successful actress, I'm really grateful. I grew up, at first when we lived there, we had a cabin, 7 of us were living in it. It was one little room, a potbelly stove and a bathroom. You had to go outside, down to the gym.
Wow.
So, I mean, I grew up like in a really kind of primitive way for an American to grow up, but it was also an amazing way to grow up. Now, having said that, within our commune, we had really worldly thinkers, but outside our commune, my sister had a Black boyfriend in a high school in Virginia, and people called her an N-lover and were fighting with her, and there was fights, you know, which drove my mom insane. It was really kind of like the town itself was like 30 years behind.
Mm.
So we'd come from a city to this place, and in a lot of ways, it was very backwards all around us.
God almighty. But you emerged triumphant.
I did. That's right. You were right. You were wrong.
I'm grateful
for all of that. You know,
to see
this in the world, to learn, to feel things, to experience poverty. I remember being little and I'd grown out of my shoes and no one on the commune had an extra pair of shoes their kid had grown out of in my size. So there was like, I didn't have shoes for a while, you know?
Mm.
Wow.
And when did you decide and how did you translate that experience into deciding to be an actress? Because you have a family political legacy, but you also have a tremendous acting legacy. When did you decide that you were going to follow in your family's footsteps with or without shoes?
Not wearing shoes right now. disclosure. My great grandparents were in vaudeville. My grandfather was successful. He did like vaudeville at 14. He was playing in speakeasies, the trombone, and then he was on live radio. He played this character, Slap Happy Grandpappy, and then he was on the Jack Parr Show and the Hollywood Squares, and then my dad was an actor. So it was part of our life. We grew up doing story theater. That was part of how we played in this commune. You know, we do theater games and things. And when I got a little bit older, my sister became an actress. My father was also an actor. And she started to be successful, and I wanted to, but I was also very afraid to do it. So I also wanted to be a midwife. So I said to myself, look, I want to be a midwife or an actor. Which choice am I going to make? You know, being an actor, you could fail. It's very unlikely you'll be successful. It's very hard to make a living. I saw my dad struggle to raise us. But I said, look, more than being an actor or being a midwife, I want to be a brave person. So I'm going to commit between 18 and 19 to being brave. That's my job. So the scarier thing is to try to be an actor. So I'm going to commit to failing every day for a year towards being an actor. So I went on an audition, or I'd dissect a movie, or I'd take an acting class every day. I'd get terrible feedback from auditions sometimes. And I'd say, you know what? I'm such a badass. I'm going to show up at the next audition and still audition. I'm not going to let it shut me down, because my real job is to be brave.
Wow.
And through that, I ended up getting a job. Had I not given myself the freedom to fail, I would never have succeeded.
Wow.
That is a powerful
story. Isn't it?
It's a powerful way of looking at the world. I mean, where did that worldview come from? I mean, America makes a fetish out of success. We know Tennessee Williams' great essay, The Catastrophe of Success. But America fetishizes success as if failing somehow pushes you out. And of course, we got the neo-fascist gangster in the White House. The very talk about failure makes him shudder. You know,
Yes.
The realm of the mothers in Goethe's classic. Where'd you get this view of the centrality of courage and bravery, Dulcis?
I think my parents had it, honestly. I mean, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer, and it was third stage, and she did a lot of research. She was a brilliant woman. You would have loved her. Great poet.
Yes.
Amazing woman. And so she ended up doing alternative methods. But watching my mom, because she said, look, there's already a shadow on my lung. I'm really early fourth stage. But talk about bravery. I mean, watching someone battle that in front of you. She was such a badass when we were little kids. There's a story that when a bus, they were waiting for the bus, her and my sister. And when the bus came, they wouldn't stop to let this handicapped person on. So my mom just laid down in front of the wheels of the bus until they stopped and let them on the bus. So she was really a powerful woman.
She was special.
Wow, that's incredible.
We understand where you come from.
I have a little tiny bit of her power, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not only the courage to fail, but it's also not to internalize that rejection as having anything to do with you.
Exactly.
Right. Say more.
Because I mean, in acting, it's all about rejection. You're at the will of all these parties. Sometimes you're in a room with 30 producers and the network and all these people, and it can just destroy you because you're also an artist. But it's not true. I mean, luckily, because my dad was an actor, he said, sweetie, all you do is you do your research beforehand, you prepare yourself, you go in the room, you have fun, you do the best job you can, you explore, and then you leave it there and it's out of your hands. And it's really not your business what they think of you.
Yeah. But I mean, it's still hard, you know, it's hard because, you know, it's human nature. We want affirmation. That's, you know, we don't want to go and be rejected, but it's very important lesson. And to do it between 18 and 19 is so perfect before there's so much to worry about, right? When you're early enough in your development to solidify that kind of thinking and that approach. I mean, that's amazing. And I mean, I'm going to take this. I might bring this to my own career at this point and give myself a whole year of failure, planned failure. You know what I mean? Because basically anything that happens that's not a horrible failure is like gravy. It's like, hey.
Every failure is a success.
Oh, that's even more intense. You see, I still haven't let go of the success model because I'm like, well, failures are fine, but maybe there'll be a little tiny bit of success.
Well, it is.
Okay, because tell me what you mean.
The payoff you get when you get a failure. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I'd go on an audition. I made a choice. It was such a boring part, okay? It was like a nothing part of the secretary, like, you know, Mr. Weaver, you have a call on line 3. It was like nothing. So I decided just to play her like a total ditz. Like during the audition, I was like dropping papers and like forgetting things. It's kind of spacing out. And anyway, I left. My agent got a call from the casting director. What the hell was wrong with her? She was horrible. You know, that was the worst, the worst audition I ever had. I said, call them back and tell them that was my acting choice. That's not who I am. But as a woman, you assume that's who I am. This is a right. Boring ass part. And this was my choice I decided to make it more interesting for me. You don't have to like it. It's fine. But I was really proud of myself for taking a chance and making a choice. And once I got that, you know, negative response, instead of shutting down, when I got my next audition, I was like, the prize that I get is totally committing myself again. Okay, there's years ago, sometimes in acting, I'll do different things. Like I have these medicine cards, which are different Native American animals, and I might pull some on a project. And I was doing this, we were building toilets in Haiti, compost toilets. And I pulled the snake card. And snake medicine is people who can ingest poison from a snake, and they ingest it and they keep getting bit and they get stronger and stronger and they build up an immunity to poison, which makes them super strong. So that's kind of how I looked at failure. Actually, every failure that came to me, I took it and I put it in me and I transformed it into medicine. And I said, that's great. I will take that failure. And instead of it being my kryptonite, it's going to nourish me. Mm-hmm. And it's going to nourish my strength to push through.
Mm. Wow.
That's some powerful wisdom.
Yeah, that really is. We're going to have to keep that. We're going to keep that on the tightrope. I'm going to put that in my little pocket.
I'm trying to think through some of my failures. If I could transmute them and transform them into some medicine.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice?
Wouldn't that be? I'd be more powerful than ever.
It not only helps you grapple with what's happened to you because of the world around us, but it also fortifies you, which is where you started out, Cornell, right? It fortifies you for what has not yet happened. So they can't come surprise you with anything because you're already ready. So Patricia, when you took this legacy, right, and it sort of ran into this sudden knowledge on the equal means equal, right, project, and then you brought this to your Oscar speech, you know, what happened then? Did you find that you had some new obstacles that were bigger or different, or did this kind of tradition of practice in relationship to these kinds of obstacles hold you in good stead? What were some of the ways in which you found you were responded to?
Well, there were wins and there were losses in that. And I mean, when I went backstage, I was about to pass out when I went backstage, and I didn't even know I really had to do all these interviews backstage. And suddenly all of my stats were out of my head. My, you know, Black women are paid 78 cents on the dollar, Latinas 55 cents on the dollar, white women 82 cents on the dollar, whatever it was that year. just were out of my head. Everything was gone. They had to give me water because I was like, I'm shaking. My adrenaline was surging so much. And so at one point they said, well, why, you know, you're saying women need equal pay and equal rights. And I said, you know, we fought for everyone else. You know, why don't they fight for them, for us? And they said, what do you mean by that? I said, women have fought for LGBT rights. Women have fought, you know, for the vote. Women have fought against slavery. I mean, women have been a part of everything. Some people perceive that I didn't think Black women were outside of that. And, you know, that's totally valuable. And that is a valid assessment. I didn't mean that, because in my heart, actually, I knew women of color were being more horribly oppressed by unequal pay. That I wasn't talking about myself. Some people were like, are you talking about Hollywood? I said, no, 90% of all businesses are paying women less money. So there was a backlash about that, which I was sad about. Now, this is where my courage didn't work. Because it actually was the opposite of what I wanted to do. And I felt so bad and responsible. And it really broke my heart. And it was the absolute polar opposite of what I was doing. So I was pretty heartbroken about it. Now, I know I just won an Oscar. I should be excited. It was a mix of all these different things. The next day, the first thing that happened when I went to work is a Black woman editor came up to me and she said, I had to find you. I found out what time you were coming in and I had to tell you. First thing this morning, my boss pulled me in and he said, listen, we're giving you a raise. And she said, what are you talking about? He said, we haven't been paying you equally. She said, thank you so much. And then that happened over and over again. I mean, women of color, some were really sad. They were going, my boss came up to me and they told me I got this check. And I thought, well, is it a bonus for something I did? And they said, no, it's we were paying you less. And when I looked at that $10,000 check, it really broke my heart that this company I work for it and I care about did this to me. And at the same time, so that was my first morning, which made me feel a little bit better. And then the next thing that happened was Senator Hannah Beth Jackson called me and she said, oh my God, I've been trying to pass this legislation in California for equal pay for years and no one's listened. But now, because of that speech, people are listening. So we were able to push through that. She got her law passed. And then subsequently 42 sister laws passed across the country. Which led to thousands of women getting paid more. Right now, actually on Newsom's desk is a really important piece of legislation that we need him to sign, which is, we'll clear this up. I think you guys probably know one of the first things in office Donald Trump did was roll back an executive order Obama had, which would have forced pay transparency to all of the government contractors. So they were gonna have to report on their salary of, you know, each department on age, sex, race, all of it. So suddenly we would have seen boom, 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 boom. How much are Black men being paid for this? How much are, you know, and then when you have transparency, then you can take a case, okay? Then you could say, hey, here's the proof. You're paying me less. So right now, well, immediately Trump rolled that back, of course, so we don't have transparency. So right now in California, Newsom has on his desk legislation to pass for transparency in California for all California contractors.
This is just amazing, the kind of response you got.
Isn't that?
This powerful speech, though. I mean, the bravery that goes all the way back to Chicago, Bentonville. Now on the national and international stage. And you think of all the grassroots organizing and folk in the streets calling for the same thing, putting the pressures, bringing power to bear. And then your voice right there in front of millions all around every corner of the globe, boom. Those kind of effects and consequences flow therefrom. I mean, it's really something to see what role an artist, a towering artist can play when he or she intervenes with vision and courage.
Well, I think also the thing is the indoctrination of being female in America. It's be nice, don't make any waves, be polite. This is your top echelon of your business. All your employees are watching. None of them were thrilled that I was calling for, you know, half of their workforce to get paid more. Also, you know, they were amongst all these industries paying people less. So I knew what I was doing was controversial, but when I thought about it, I was like, I'm winning this Oscar for a woman struggling to raise her kids. And how would her life have been different? And how would my mom's life have been different? Mm. You know, my mom at one point wanted to leave my dad, and she said, I can't support you guys. And I have cancer, and I will lose my insurance, because while I've been with him for 30 years, 6 months after I leave him, I will be dropped and I have a pre-existing condition. Mm. It's like your value as a woman didn't matter. Your life's work was raising a family. It doesn't matter.
Right.
So I said, look, if this does happen and if I do win, I want everyone to win. I want to take this and make this something that helps a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so powerful.
But that's what you did. That's what you did.
I mean, you know, these things, what your example and what the story, the movie you won the Oscar for, you know, what they bring together is a combination of the ways in which women are placed on pedestals for this illusion of, you know, motherhood and family responsibility, but how that is required to be a subset of a patriarchal context, so that their very elevation is attached to their domination. Because if mothers were so valued in the first place, then there would be health insurance for them and their children. They wouldn't have to be married in order to survive economically. It wouldn't be reasonable for women with children to be paid less systematically, because all of that, you know, begins with the principle that women work for extra money, that the men are the breadwinners, a patriarchal, you know, heteronormative, you know, homophobic framework. And you know, so you brought all of that together at that point. Now that was 2015, is that right?
Yeah.
So 2 years later, you're involved in the Women's March. Tell me, sort of walk us through that journey, because, you know, that was an amazing January. I will say, you know, it was very exhilarating. I mean, it had its flaws and there were issues and there are things always to work on. And women are not a monolithic group. Right. It's very complicated to figure out how to talk about gender across all the things that intersect. But yeah. I thought the Women's March was very powerful and very inspiring. And you were, you know, a central part of it. Talk a little bit about how you got involved and you know, what your experience was.
I really wasn't a central part of it. I didn't speak. And I had as soon as Donald Trump won, I mean, and I heard about it, I just booked my ticket because I was so furious that he had won. So I was there and I was watching the speeches and I was, you know, with my body being one of the million bodies or however many we were all there, but I really had no part of major participation. I think part of the reason was this backlash from my speech. You know, so it was kind of a mixed
experience
being there. It wasn't painful, only in that I carried pain I thought maybe I was had somehow contributed to other people. You know, it was weird. It was interesting because I feel like I carried a lot of shame with that thing at the same time. And I'm not sure I've exactly let that all go. You know.
What kind of shame is this? I mean, what's the source of the shame that you've been a force for good? You've been.
Yeah, I think it's just I really see and believe and hear and have seen the pain of my sisters of color who have had worse off. And to contribute even a morsel or a crumb to that feeling other than that not feeling contributed to or supported in some kind of way, I just have a lot of shame about having even accidentally caused any kind of pain to anyone. You know, it's a lot to carry, I think, yeah, in this world.
So the critique was that because you talked about women as a monolith, just saying women should be paid more, that somehow this was a kind of white female centered analysis and that it didn't adequately take women of color into account. Is that the basic argument? Well, that,
because I said, you know, people have fought for civil rights, you know, women have fought for civil rights. I also said women fought for LGBT rights. A lot of LGBT people got mad at me too. Mm-hmm. A lot of lesbians were like, we are women. I was like, I never said you weren't women. I mean,
Right. No, so what they read was that you were saying this other group of women that were not Black, that were not queer, that were not trans, right, is somehow this, the we you were referring to, when what you meant was we've been embedded in all of these communities. Women as a whole are embedded in all of these communities, and we're as diverse as any other group of people, but we all share this particular role in the world. Is that what you, right? So that's, well, what got misunderstood.
Thought that, yeah, they thought I was excluding LGBT women, and I was excluding Black women, and I was excluding whatever. But I mean, of course I'm including Black women. In my mind, like, yes, Black women are women, lesbians are women. To me, my sister was transgender. She blew the lid on being a transgender actress. She, you know, lost work. She did all this. She was a transgender activist. I see her as a woman too. I mean, so for me, I was like, my sister's trans, a trans woman. What the hell are you talking about?
And this is Sister Alexis you're talking about?
Yes, Alexis. Yes,
absolutely.
So anyway,
Well, this is very complicated, and you know, people are so hurt that they take these things very much to heart. And, you know, it's a sign of how treacherous it is out here. And unfortunately, you know, I feel as though it discourages people from doing the kinds of brave acts that you did, because they feel they have to be perfect at expressing it. And there's no opportunity to clarify. And some of this is media, some of it is, you know, secondhand information that gets shared incoherently. And some of it is that, you know, we learn as we go, right? I mean, you pretty much came to this gendered analysis, what it sounds like, was just a couple of years prior, really, right? And that takes some time to figure out all the nuances of. I'm really sorry that happened. I feel badly about that, because, you know, when you're in, your spirit is in the right place, it's particularly frustrating and hurtful when people really misinterpret you.
I mean, having said that, I don't mean to be whining about my experience, because I really think it's nothing compared to the people hurt by it, who have a lifetime of being hurt by things. And rightly so, they're saying, I'm sick of being hurt by things. So I don't want to contribute to that. And I want to hold their pain, and I want to honor their pain, and I don't want to be a part of it. So I thank you for what you're saying. And I think there's a place for all this, but also they say, like in what is it? Kabbalah. They say it's good to break your ego too. It's good to have your ego broken and examine, like, what's mine, what's not mine, what did I do?
And also, you know, it's a learning opportunity, right? Because what the challenge was about the framing of the argument, right? Mm-hmm. And to figure out, okay, what new language can I read about, deploy, be in conversation with, so that I'm not put in this position again, and then I can continue to use my formidable gifts, which you have, for the forces of good that are necessary. And we need you right now. We need you to win another Oscar and make another speech right away before the end of this month. So get on it, you know, because
this monster.
It's mayhem out here.
Real. It's horrifying. And for women's rights, I mean, they're gonna destroy the ACA. First of all, because he hates Barack Obama, anything about Barack Obama. They have no healthcare plan. You know, they're ruled by the medical industry and pharma, big pharma. And
the insurance.
Before the ACA, women paid substantially more for health insurance because they considered our uterus a pre-existing condition.
Don't even get me started. You know, I'm apoplectic, you know, that kind of thing. If it's a pre-existing condition, then we should only have women. We should tell all these men, we should say, we're not having any more boys. I'm sorry. Your half of the species is over. You know,
we won't if it's have a pre-existing right to abortion.
Right.
I mean, and the sad reality is that if men had uterus, we'd have Medicare for all. It would have been naturalized and normalized a long time ago. I mean,
that's the real truth.
Ugliness in terms of the patriarchal blindness and ignorance and greed that goes into trying to sustain sexist projects. But it seems to me, though, the one thing to keep in mind, though, is one thing to break the ego. And we appreciate the Jewish mystical tradition and its richness. But it's another thing to dampen your spirit. Mm. And it seems to me the crucial thing is, when I get those kind of criticisms, I say to folk, nothing is going to stand in the way of me being in solidarity with your suffering and your resistance. So I appreciate you educating me. I appreciate you broadening my vision. That was not my intention, but if it was misunderstood, okay, it was misunderstood, but we are going forward together. So we're going to have a feminist analysis that's grounded in struggling against white supremacy, struggling against, you know, predatory capitalism in terms of the 1% Wall Street connection with sisters all around the world in terms of critiques of empire. So you say, I am Brother West, Sister Tricia, Sister Patricia, nothing gonna stand in the way of us being in solidarity, even as we're in the process of learning. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you just go and do your thing. You're gonna do your thing after that. Hey, yep. That's it.
Right,
you're
making me cry.
No, and that's what you've been doing, though. But exactly. I want to ask you a question about the great Betty Davis, because I think in so many ways she's the greatest actor that I know.
And
I just thinking in terms of your own vocation as an artist, who feeds into your conception of your artistry? It could be, I just mentioned a woman because I think she's the greatest, but I mean, you got Denzel Washington, you got Cecily Tyson, there's a whole host of folk. But who are some of those that feed into your conception of the kind of artist that you are?
Oh, that's a good question. Honestly, I really pick around. It's like, you know, I will watch Betty Davis or Cicely Tyson. I just like great acting. Acting is food. So for me as an actor, I'm so excited when somebody does an amazing performance. It just, I feel like every cell of my body gets filled up. And I have a million new thoughts and I wonder how they did it. And I break it down. So there's a lot of great actors. And then sometimes people have a great performance in an otherwise not amazing career. They don't hit it out of the park every time, or every part's not capable of, you know, doing that. But I mean, I really need good acting food.
Throughout time.
It really inspires me.
So you basically draw from great acting across the board, across the spectrum of actors. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, in some ways, that's what we do as intellectuals, is read across the board, right? And take the best of what we can find and leave the rest behind. We don't love every word been written by anybody.
That's exactly right.
But
I'm so grateful for you doing that reading. And then, you know, putting it through your lens and putting your spin on things and putting it out in the world, like our species keeps growing and getting educated because of people like you that are sharing your knowledge.
Yeah, well, I have to say, Cornell, I do my little bit, but Cornell's extraordinary at that.
It's more than a little bit. It's more than a little bit.
I'll do a moderate amount. But your point was well taken from the beginning about, you know, getting academics to write textbooks, although that would only depress the hell out of me, but because it would just be such a tough assignment that would be rejected. But you're right. How do we get this kind of critical engagement about women, people of color, communities, aggrieved communities, the poor? Or you don't even learn about poor people. I mean, my first class on women's history was in college. I mean, it was the first. My first class on African-American history was in college. And I went to a very elite private high school in Manhattan in New York. I was a, you know, affirmative action child, full scholarship. And I thought I went to the best school. I was like, I learned all I needed to know. I was all set. You know, I got to college, was like, what? I was like, wait, hold time out. What happened? You know, and I was pissed. I was like, well, I wasted my time. I could have stayed in public school if I was going to not learn everything that mattered. but you're also concerned with other projects beside these issues. You have a new project coming out with Woody Harrelson. You want to talk about that a little bit? Kiss the Ground. Isn't that about ecological disaster? And
well, it's about like restorative agriculture and how mm-hmm. we can deal with climate change and feeding the world through more restorative practices. But it's a documentary, and they interviewed my group, which is givelove.org. Mm. And we do ecological sanitation in the developing world. So we have projects like in Uganda and Kenya with our partners, and putting toilets in schools that are, you know, safe and kill all pathogens so that kids can have a safe experience. And when you learn about women's rights and through the world and women's history, I mean, we know that when there's a safe bathroom for girls to go to when they're menstruating, when they start menstruation, they stay in school. We know this all over the world, the numbers are higher. So it really impacts girls and women so much, the lack of bathrooms. So right. This is a project that we've been working on. And in that documentary, they talk about our compost sanitation solutions. More people have cell phones than toilets in the world. And the lack of sanitation and waterborne disease kills more kids under 5 than AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined.
Wow.
Yeah, that's critical. Wow. And the intersection there is a brilliant analysis there between public health, you know, adolescent femininity and women's, you know, vulnerability, education as a form of self-determination and the capacity to imagine your own future, right? All together. Wow, that's really...
And there's been some analysis and several studies where they've shown the impacts of climate change are going to be hardest felt on women. And in fact, because women may have to turn to prostitution to survive, you know, to feed their kids. And there was this analysis of this one giant, not tsunami, like typhoon that killed quite a lot of people. And the majority of them were women because they had to stay back and care for the elderly, little children. They had none of their own personal financial capacity right. to pick up right. and leave. So yeah. Well, we know that climate change is going to impact women the hardest, women and children. You know, we need to get on this now. And that's basically what this movie is about.
That's great.
That's another powerful project you were part of, though. It's amazing how much you're able to get in one lifetime. It's like, wow.
I'm telling you.
I mean, it's hard enough just learning the lines in boyhood. I mean, how do you put all that together?
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. Yeah, and take such good roles. I mean, I've always admired, you know, the kind of women that you play, and that they're meaningful. They're rich characters. Even your TV show, you know, I mean, you know, TV is very good now, but back in the day, you know, it was okay, and you were just fantastic. And I just really admire your capacity to take what, you know, can be a pretty problematic industry in terms of the representations of women, and to figure out how to take that 18, 19 year old self and, you know, put that standard to bear on the work you do. And now, I mean, that says a tremendous amount.
Well, I definitely feel really, really grateful and lucky, because it is a really hard business to make a living in. And I'm glad that I got to see how hard it is by my dad trying to feed us all and keep a roof over our heads. But I do think that kind of work ethic came from him. And I think a lot of my whole family, like Alexis with her trans rights work and me with the women's rights work. And Rosanna was one of the first people that came out for Me Too. And she got a lot of grief about that. Mm-hmm. But then I was saying, who cares? You know what? They're talking about in the Japanese parliament. Nuns are coming out saying they were raped by priests. Like, this is a global conversation.
Right.
It's been a long time coming, you know? I mean, Tarana Burke had been talking about it for years, and people were ignoring it. Finally, it caught on. The world was ready. And her work that she'd been working so hard at for so long got to be known. Yeah. And Rosanna got to be a part of that story. And I think that's really great.
Yeah, it is. We still got a lot more fighting to do because, you know, it's good to focus on some of the extremes, you know, like a Harvey Weinstein and so on, even a Bill Cosby. But the general place where this happens is so much more normalized and regular, right? And less extreme, but in the day-to-day lives of women, it's just as extreme because it's diffuse, right? It's everywhere. It's not just here are the three monsters, let me go the other way. It's built into the practices of the workplace in every industry. And, you know, there's a lot still left to do. So, like I said, you got to win another Oscar. We got speeches for you.
Okay, good. I'm going to call you guys.
Feel free. I'll help.
What do we need to do?
I'll be waiting backstage with water and a critical defense if needed. Okay. I'll be backstage with whatever's needed.
Oh, my gosh. You're the best.
Well, it's been such a joy to have you with us.
It's been wonderful. This has been wonderful. The beautiful thing is, in the middle of all of this grimness, that you still have your joy. You know what I mean? That's the crucial thing when you got a reactionary backlash. They try to beat us down. No alternative, no vision. Rob you of your joy. No, Sister Patricia got a joy that folk can't steal away. Well, that's very important because that allows you to keep being the force for good that you are. And that's what we talk about on the show a lot with my dear sister, Tricia. And it's just so good to see that kind of joy bubbling over in that way.
Thank you. Well, I also, you said earlier about ACA, the coronavirus thing, I think suddenly healthcare for all is going to make a lot more sense to people. So.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
But, that's, you know, so it's definitely, I think people are less worried about the I's, the crossing of the T's and the dotting of the I's. They're more like, look, in principle, this is what we need. Mm-hmm. I hope that's the case. But yeah, I hope so. But I mean, we're just really delighted to hear what you're doing. Your commitment is dogged, but your spirit is joyful, as Cornell said. So, I mean, that's a beautiful combination because it's hard work. It's hard work, but there's so much reward in it. So we hope you continue to do it and keep us inspired along the way.
Thank you both. You're just a huge blessing. And the gifts you give to people, especially at this time when people are at home, is immeasurable. So thank you both so much for your work.
Well, it's a total pleasure to be with you, to be with Dr. Cornell West every week. It really doesn't get too much more fun than that. So thank you for joining us.
And we will
come back and join us on the tightrope anytime, Patricia.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Cornell, you know, I've been reflecting on the interview we had with Dr. Fauci, which I really loved. But, you know, you might remember that I mentioned that there was going to be a new audio biography. It's an Audible format of audio biography, and they're set to release at the time of our interview. But now the actual audio biography is in the library, and I'm kind of interested in listening to it after meeting Fauci on the Tightrope episode. He was amazing, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, no, Brother Anthony Fauci, he's very, very fascinating, brother. And Michael Spector put it together. He wrote it. He directed it. I think he's done a magnificent job on it. I know people are hungry and thirsty to know more about Brother Fauci, Dr. Fauci. And we thank Malcolm Gladwell for his Pushkin Company playing a crucial role there as well. But I hope people get a chance to check out that Audible product connected to Brother Fauci.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm glad you emphasized Michael Spector and Malcolm Gladwell's company, because people might think, you know, Anthony Fauci wrote it himself, which he clarified on our episode for those of you who weren't there, but he did give it his blessing. And it has all kinds of interviews and archival audio of him, his wife, Christine Grady, and a whole bunch of others. So, you know, he was great on our show. And so because he was so willing to listen and really drill down with your fantastic questions about what motivates him and drives him and what traditions shape him. I'm looking forward to learning more about that in his autobiography.
Absolutely. No, I hope people get a chance to check out more about our dear brother Fauci. He is a pivotal character in this grim moment. He's a source of hope.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, in an autobiography, you can take it anywhere you need to go. So I just want to tell everyone in our tightrope family, I really hope you all go back and check that Dr. Fauci episode of ours. You know, if you're a streamer, and then download it from any of your favorite streaming platforms. If you're a visual type, check us out on youtube.com/thetightropepod. And don't forget to check out the new autobiography on Dr. Anthony Fauci called Fauci. So can't forget that title. That's pretty easy to remember. And if you're new to Audible and you'd like to check them out, visit audible.com/thetightropepod and get yourself a free download. Or you can just text the tightrope pod to 50-50. Okay, time to step back out onto the tightrope, Doc. You ready?
Let's step.
Okay, well, this was a fantastic episode today. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. It was really a joy. And don't forget to share whatever your favorite episode is on social media. Subscribe so you can get messages about what's coming up next. And please join us the next time on The Tightrope. Take care now.